This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Enemies Within the Church, a documentary that will expose the false teachers and underlying agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world. For more information, visit enemieswithinthechurch.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thank you so much for joining us again. I do not understand the way some people think. That's just kind of a broad-based statement. It applies in a lot of arenas, but it particularly applies with what was just done by the National Association of Evangelicals and the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, NAE and CCCU. I don't get them. I don't know why they're doing what they're doing, but they have now endorsed these concepts of protecting the categories of sexual orientation and gender identity in federal non-discrimination laws. What are we talking about here? Well, if you go back, you'll recall that we had the introduction of legislation called ENDA for years. It was Congressman Barney Frank who introduced this legislation every single year, I think for about 20 years or so. And the whole thrust of it was we want to be able to have federal non-discrimination protection for sexual orientation and gender identity. And Congress rightly said for years and years and years, no, we're not doing that, because they understood the ramifications of it. We have the protected classes in federal non-discrimination law of things like race and religion and sex. And I kind of laugh about that now, because we had a big consensus on the fact that sex is an immutable characteristic. Those were the days. Of course, that was then and this is now. But anyway, we understood that race is immutable, sex is immutable, and religion is protected under the First Amendment. So, of course, we have protected categories. You can't discriminate against somebody based on those categories because of those reasons. Sexual orientation and gender identity are not immutable, and they're not protected by the Constitution, and there's no reason to invent new rights, particularly when we've seen what's gone on in the last several years, where post-Obergefell, we've seen these sexual radicals weaponize this ideology against Christians. Again and again and again, Kim Davis goes to jail. Jack Phillips has to go to the Supreme Court. The Kleins lose their business in Oregon, their bakery, over this idea that they're not allowed to have moral or religious grounds for saying, I really don't want to be involved in your so-called same-sex wedding. Thank you very much. Nope, no opting out, no opting out. It's a totalitarian ideology, and we see it for what it is now. So what in the world is going on with these evangelical groups saying, let's find a compromise? Because that's what it really is all about. What they're trying to do, in essence, is they're trying to say, all right, well, the landscape is looking a little different now, and we see these sexual radicals gaining more ground, getting more power, and religious freedom is under threat. So why don't we come together and try to make a good faith effort to convince them that if we meet them halfway, then they probably will meet us halfway. Insert sarcastic laugh here, because there's no way. When have these people on the radical side of the fence ever said, we'll meet you halfway, Christians? The only time they ever do that is when they understand that politically they can't yet get what they want. And so they modify it and they tone it down until they get to the point where you can move the goalposts far enough to understand, now I can get what I want. Nobody back in 2000, which was the year that they began to even come up with this phrase gay marriage, would have ever thought that Obergefell could be proposed, much less rendered in a decision at the U.S. Supreme Court. That blew everybody away, not just us. It blew the radicals away. They didn't think they would get it so soon. They always wanted it, but they didn't think they were going to get it in 2015, and they got it. So they have made remarkable progress. But think about it. It was incremental. There was a time in which people were discussing alternative lifestyles, and that was shocking enough. Now it looks so tame as to not even believe that that was ever something that sounded crazy. But that was what they were saying. It's an alternative lifestyle. Now we're on to, you either allow your daughter to get surgery to become a son, or you can't retain custody. I mean, that's where we are in a mere 18 years since the year 2000. It's stunning to see what's going on. But these radicals have never, ever, unless it was politically expedient to do so, told Christians, we'll meet you halfway. Why? Here's why. They will not meet Christians halfway because Christians are the problem. And I don't know why this is difficult for people to understand. You're the problem, Christian. You and your God are a big problem because what does the Word of God say? The law of God is written on our hearts. Romans 1 tells us clearly that we know that there is a creator simply by looking at creation. We understand when we're standing in front of an ocean or we're looking at a gorgeous mountain range or we're looking at a beautiful sunset that somebody had to have made that. We know that. Ask any little kid. Little kids are not atheists by nature. They understand when you talk about God, they grasp the concept of God very easily because we are designed to grasp the concept of God very easily. It's only when you get older and you start reading new atheist material that you begin to get a twisted mind and understand that, oh, well, you know, maybe I can reinvent this whole thing. It's called suppressing the truth in righteousness. And that's something that Romans 1 also talks about. Sinful man does not want there to be a God by nature because we don't want somebody to whom we will be accountable. And might I add, Romans 1 also has a fair amount to say about homosexuality and a depraved mind and how God gives cultures over to a depraved mind when they suppress the truth and righteousness. I think we're pretty far down that trail already. So why in the world would Christians look at this landscape and say, let's compromise with them? Well, there are those who would say, we're living in a pluralistic society. We understand we all have to coexist. I've got the bumper sticker to prove it. They never do that. Why would Christians do that? And here's what's really lousy about it. World Magazine did a story on this and pointed out that these compromises were made, and it was basically, you know, endorsing a framework for this. It's not like there's a specific law that they're endorsing, like the Equality Act. Although, who knows, when progressives seize the White House and control of the House and the Senate once again, and the Equality Act becomes a reality and criminalizes Christianity, in effect, who knows how many of these so-called evangelical groups will be on board with it. But they're endorsing the framework. Okay, fine. You can have your sexual orientation and gender identity protections in federal law. Just please let us have our religious freedom. Now, you know, why do you need to compromise? We have the First Amendment already. We already have full-blown religious freedom. What you're really doing is saying, let's give special rights to homosexuals, transgenders, bisexuals, and whatever other category Facebook wants to add to the mix today. It's so ridiculous. It's a fool's errand. Everett Piper, our friend from Oklahoma Wesleyan University, had a piece on this over at the Washington Times and said this is absolutely ridiculous that any Christian group would fall for this nonsense. He says, first, it is legally and politically untenable to pretend you can grant minority status to any group of people and then maintain for yourself an exemption to deny these people the minority protections you just granted them. Excellent point. And they would not have that anyway. There's no way they would get those protections under federal law and then say, let's carve out an exemption. In fact, the movement for the last several years has been no religious exemptions. No religious exemptions in any law that is designed to, quote unquote, protect LGBT rights. Give them credit. They're full-blown, you know, radicals, and that's what radicals do. He goes on to say, if sexual orientation and gender identity, a moving target and transient definition, if ever there were one, are granted minority class status under federal law, what in the world makes the religious institution think that its religious freedoms should or will ever trump the civil rights of the protected group it just recognized? And even Kai Feldblum of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission agrees with this fact when she boasts of the zero-sum game where the rights of LGBT Americans will be secured only by curtailing the rights of religious Americans. LGBT community rights cannot be adequately advanced if pockets of resistance are permitted to flourish. That's from Kai Feldblum. And just in case anybody, such as our leaders in the NAE, missed her point, she concludes no individual exceptions based on religious beliefs should ever be allowed if they conflict with the goal of liberty for gay people. It's ridiculous that they're doing this, and I just can't imagine what appeasement is going to give Christians. What's really bad about it, and Rob Gagnon also wrote a piece about this, what's really bad about this is that they are failing to heed the voices of people like Dr. Gagnon and others who have been on the forefront of this issue as evangelicals and as Christians for a long time and know this agenda inside and out. Why in the world would you not heed the voices of the people who are the wisest on this very issue that's at stake? Who knows what kinds of associations they have or the people they're working with and all kinds of ideology that they're now embracing. But it is a fool's errand. It's going to go nowhere fast. It's lousy for Christians and they need to strike it. It's a stupid idea, if I may say so. And I just did. We're going to go to a break. We'll be back right after this on Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. How can Christians stand on God's word at a time when radical activists want to compromise the church on the issue of biblical sexuality? A rising tide of LGBT activism is becoming apparent inside our churches. Wearing a religious facade, these activists talk about LGBT Christians and sexual minorities, and their goal is to move our churches away from the word of God. It's time for the church to defend biblical truth without compromise. That's why I'd like to invite you to join me, Janet Mefford, at the God's Voice Conference, a biblical response to the queering of the church. Sponsored by First Stone Ministries, God's Voice will bring clarity to the confusion surrounding revoiced sexuality and identity. Our team of experts will demonstrate how the language of the LGBT Christian movement is rooted not in the Bible, but in the same ideology that has wreaked havoc on our culture. The God's Voice Conference will take place February 22nd and 23rd in Oklahoma City, and we want to see you there. It's time for the church to bow the knee to God's voice. To register or for more information, visit godsvoice.us. That's godsvoice.us. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Well, some big news. A federal judge in the Northern District of Texas has now ruled that Obamacare is unconstitutional. This was a decision handed down in that lawsuit brought by Texas and other states seeking to declare the individual mandate unconstitutional because that tax penalty for failing to buy insurance has now been removed. What does this ruling mean for the future of Obamacare? And also, what might happen if it once again ends up before the Supreme Court? And it's very likely to do so. We're going to check in now with health policy expert Dr. Merrill Matthews, resident scholar with the Institute for Policy Innovation. So glad to have you here, Dr. Matthews. And we've got some big news. As I said, this is really very encouraging for a lot of people.
It is. We've been talking about this for a long time, Janet, though I'm wondering if some Republicans are not that encouraged, because in the recent election, Democrats were running ads about the pre-existing condition issue, the Republicans, claiming the Republicans wanted to take that away and then people would have trouble finding health insurance. And Republicans did not mount a very good defense against that criticism, and now Democrats are coming back. Nancy Pelosi said, when we come in Congress, we're going to try to pass this legislation to make sure that this goes forward stops this legal process right now. And I think some Republicans are kind of be shy of doing that.
Yes, absolutely. It's going to be interesting to see how the political ramifications play out. But what is your sense of this ruling? The judge's reasoning, I know, has been bandied about by various pundits. Even National Review was a little bit critical of this ruling. What is your take on it?
Well, I'm surprised he struck down the whole law, because there are things in the legislation that really have nothing to do with health insurance. For instance, your listeners are familiar with generics, prescription drugs, and generics. There's another one called biologics. Those are when they give you injectables mostly. They needed a generic version for that to be able to try to move biologics to generic versions. That's in the law. And so I used to say when you want to repeal the whole thing, remember there are a few things in there that needed to be done that were tacked onto the legislation that really doesn't have anything to do with health insurance. And so striking down the whole law, I think it's going to go, assuming it moves forward, it will go to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. That is generally considered a conservative court. My guess is they would, even if they agree with Judge O'Connor on the basics of this, I think they would pare back some of that severability that he did and allow some parts of the law to continue to stand.
Right. Now, this is very interesting because I know Congress has stated three times that the individual mandate was absolutely essential to Obamacare, and I know that was the basis on which this judge had made the ruling. But there are also questions about whether or not that was really okay to do because the tax penalty was removed. It went down to zero. But does that really invalidate the entire law? I mean, how are we to understand the thinking here on the part of the judge and some of the criticisms of the way that this reasoning was taking place?
Right. So when this came before the Supreme Court in 2012, the question was, could Congress mandate people buy health insurance under the Constitutional Commerce Clause, which gives Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce?
Right.
The five conservative justices said, no, it does not work under the Commerce Clause. Chief Justice Roberts said the Commerce Clause allows Congress to regulate commerce, not mandate it. So they said no to that. But then Roberts went rogue and said, but Congress has the power to tax. The mandate, if you don't buy health insurance, there's a penalty. That's a tax. It's written as a tax. It's collected by the Treasury and so forth. So it's a tax. And he sided with the four left-leaning justices and saying the law can stand because by himself, he considered this a tax. Now, because they zeroed out the tax, and said that they didn't repeal that part of the law. They simply said the Treasury cannot collect tax on this. Is a tax that is set at zero still a tax? And that's one of the questions they'll have to ask. What Judge O'Connor ruled was, and he's following the proponents of the law, they said this is absolutely connected. The individual mandate and the ability to be able to tax this, they go hand in hand. You can't have the one without the other. Now that Congress has eliminated one of them, he's essentially said, all right, I'm going to buy your argument. You can't have one without the other. So he struck down the whole thing.
Yeah, but now what about this argument that the decision by Congress to eliminate that tax without eliminating the rest of the law, does that show that Congress doesn't think the mandate was essential to the law? In other words, regardless of whether or not the tax went down to zero, the fact that they didn't eliminate the law, but just dealt with the tax part of the law, I know that the judge said, you know, the intent of Congress was clear because of its past statements, but
right.
What of that issue?
Well, the only reason they eliminated the level of the tax is because they were moving under a process called reconciliation, where they didn't have to get 60 votes in the Senate. The Republicans wanted to eliminate the mandate, but they couldn't do it because that would have triggered 60 votes. So they said the Republicans were allowed to make tax provisions. So they just said, we're taking the tax down to zero, which, as far as most of us are concerned, has the same impact. But then it becomes a question of law. Is a tax at zero an eliminated tax, or is it still just a tax at zero?
Yeah, which seems like such a weird kind of parsing to do, because if the IRS told me on April 15th, your tax is zero, I would consider that not taxing me.
And you would thank them.
I would love them. Yes, I'd send them a thank you note.
That's right. And my guess is, Judge O'Connor, I've been reading through his statement, he goes through that process as well. And he feels like that by taking it to zero, that was expressing the intent of Congress to make it essentially eliminate it. So that's where he's sort of pegging off that their intent was to eliminate it. They just couldn't do it because of going through the reconciliation process. And so he went a little bit above and beyond what I think some people thought he would do in both agreeing with the plaintiffs in this case, the roughly 20 states that filed the lawsuit, and then eliminating the whole law was, I think, that was an eyebrow raiser for a lot of people, because not even the plaintiffs were arguing for elimination of the whole law.
Yeah. Now, the ruling said the mandate, as you mentioned before, the Interstate Commerce Clause, the ruling said the mandate is unsustainable under that clause. The Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional under that clause as well, but could be held up, as you said, under Congress's taxing power. So does the taxing power angle still hold up, though, in light of some of the changes on the legal front since 2012?
You know, that's the issue. A lot of things have changed. And one of the things that have happened is a number of people have health insurance. Millions of people have health insurance through the Obamacare exchanges. If you were to eliminate it, it would have some impact on employer-based coverage. That's about 160 million Americans and their dependents. Would have a little bit on Medicaid and Medicare. You put those together, you're about 125 million Americans. But those in the individual market who buy their own coverage, it would have some impact on them. And so courts tend to take that in consideration. How many people will be hurting if we pare back this law? And that's not insubstantial.
Well, it's not. Although, what is the bigger number? Will there be more people hurt by eliminating Obamacare, or more people hurt if we continue to see the skyrocketing health care costs? I mean, it depends, I guess, which group you're in.
That's the really interesting question, because you hear the numbers say there's about 17 million who have Obamacare coverage. That is, either through the exchanges or they buy it themselves on the individual market. But the number of people who were in the individual market prior to Obamacare was about 17 million people.
Oh, wow.
It typically ranged from about 16 million to 18 million people. That number is roughly the same. The primary reason the number of uninsured has gone down is because of the expansion of Medicaid, and most states. So arguably, if you got rid of it in the individual market, you would still have 16 or 17 million people in the individual market. They would just go back to buying traditional health insurance, like my wife, through the individual market.
Yes. Now, what about the DOJ's request that the rules on pre-existing conditions be struck down? How did that play out?
I haven't seen what he said on the Department of Justice. What I've seen was primarily focusing on what the plaintiffs have said. But the Department of Justice, as you point out, weighed in, wanting to have this part repealed. And so we'll have to see where that goes with the Fifth Circuit. That will be, I suspect, the decision from them next year. And then you may get that done in time to get to the Supreme Court, or maybe not.
Wow. So it's going to go to the Fifth Circuit. As you mentioned, this is more conservative circuit. If it ends up before the Supreme Court, then what is the argument on the other side that might undo this decision? What's the alternate version of this ruling?
Well, here's the first thing to remember. The five people who found this constitutional are still on the court.
True.
The two
yes.
replacements were just replacements for the conservative leaning people. So Justice Roberts and the four liberals are still there. So it's not entirely clear if it got back to them that they would actually change anything. And they might very well say, no, we would find that a tax of zero is still a tax. And so Congress can change that next time if they want to. But the Judge O'Connor, in doing this, argued that you'd have to go back through the law and make this make it to raise the tax up, because it's a law that essentially eliminated the tax. But he argues that it's not clear where the Supreme Court would decide on this. But by doing this, it may very well trigger the fight.
Yes, it would. How long? Go ahead.
I was going to say, just for those who nothing seems to change right now. So people who have this, don't worry about it immediately. This is going to be a process.
Yes, because there was no injunction handed down. Good point. Well, Dr. Merrill Matthews, you can check out his work at IPI.org. Thanks so much, Dr. Matthews, for checking in with us. By the way, I just want to reiterate how grateful we are for your partnership with Heart for Lebanon. I want to thank you again for all that you have recently done for hurting refugee kids, because together we have provided food and a Christian education for children at Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers. These are great places where kids learn, but more importantly, they get introduced to Jesus Christ, as do their families. A wonderful ministry, and we thank you. If you missed your opportunity, you can still give at heartforlebanon.org. We'll be back right after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Enemies Within the Church, a documentary that will expose the false teachers and underlying agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world. For more information, visit enemieswithinthechurch.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Well, as the end of the year draws near, one of the issues on a lot of Christians' minds is how best to honor God in year-end giving, as well as investing in God-honoring ways into the new year. So we are going to get some guidance on that today from Dan Celia. Dan is president and CEO of Financial Issues Stewardship Ministries and national radio host of Financial Issues. And it's wonderful to have you with us, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Janet, and it's great to be with you. Sure, do appreciate some time together with you, so thank you.
Oh, absolutely. It's always great to talk to you, Dan. Well, this is the time of year when many of us are saying, all right, I need to kind of up my year-end giving. There are some ministries maybe I want to support or give a little bit of extra money to my church. How do you advise Christians to handle year-end giving?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things I try to stress is that it's a great idea to be thinking about obviously giving all year long. I always tell them, look, find out where you are with your church. You know, my church, I do this all the time, and it drives them crazy. I know it does. But about the 1st of November, I said, can you send me a statement on 1st of December to see what I've got to make up?
Yeah.
I feel like I really want to be vigilant about giving to my church. And I tell everybody, look, we have to understand that we're God's instruments. God's not coming into your church or any church to write the electric bill. His people will do that. And we've got to be vigilant about giving to our church. It's up to us to keep the church doors open.
Yep.
And we've got to do that first and foremost. So, you know, I encourage people that, you know, find out, maybe try this year, at the beginning of the year in January, say, have some goals. My wife and I have a simple goal. We try to give more this year than we did last year, and we try to continue that.
Okay.
And we've been blessed to be able to do that. But I'm going to tithe to all of it to my church, and I would like to do some additional sacrificial giving here, there, or the other place, and make sure they're good, solid ministries that are proclaiming the truth. You know, we never get bothered by telemarketers that are calling, asking for money for different things, because when we used to get those calls, we always said, well, tell us how we'd love to give. Tell us how you're furthering the gospel message, proclaiming the gospel. And that usually ends the call. But it's better than ends the call. It takes us off the list.
Perfect.
Because, you know, I get a chance to say we are committed to giving to those things that are helping to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ. So, I mean, there are plenty of people giving to some very, very good organizations that aren't necessarily Christian organizations, but doing a good work, and that's wonderful. But as God's people, we want to give to those things. You know, we have a stewardship responsibility first for the gospel of Jesus Christ, and we need to be giving to those things. So I tell people in the beginning of the year, try to lay out a plan and then try to stick to it.
Good.
You know, to try to give to it, but don't, you know, give first to your church. Maybe, you know, I know people that give some of their tithes to their church, some of, you know, a couple percent here and a couple percent there to other ministries. You know, I won't speak to that, but the more we give, the greater the blessing, and we don't give for the blessing. We should be giving. So I believe, Janet, and I've said this so many times, that giving is the greatest act of worship that we can do. It's the greatest act of worship. I believe that the Lord spoke so much about money because certainly he knew how tightly we were going to hang on to it. So tight that it might even lead us to worshiping our money and taking our eyes off of Christ. And I think him knowing that, I think there is a certain sense of joy when his people give freely and joyfully over something that their nature is wanting to cling to, but yet they do it anyway.
Yeah.
And I believe that's what makes it such a wonderful act of worship. So rule number one is don't deprive yourself of the worship of God. The other thing is, it's so important, and we all know this, but we've got to work on this time of year in particular and staying out of debt, working on doing things that are within our means.
Good.
To buy it if it's in our checking account, not if we have that credit on our credit card.
Right.
And to stay out of debt, because debt's going to hinder our giving. It's going to prevent our giving. It shouldn't, but it does, and it will, because we only have capacities for, you know, a certain amount of money every month. So be certain that this time of year you are more focused on the gift, the worship, the joy of giving, and try to work hard to stay out of debt.
Well, all that stuff is so important, and I want to pick up on what you just mentioned, because it is a really pressure-filled time of year for a lot of people who say, oh, I got to get Christmas gifts for all these people and my extended family and my friends and people at work and people at church and my kids and all the rest. And there is a lot of pressure on people. There are a lot of companies that are constantly in our faces, sale here, coupon here. How do you advise families to stay within their budget for Christmas time and not get sucked in? Because they really do this, especially to us women. You walk into a store and they have this great display, and if you spend 20, you'll get a free gift. And they do all these extra little marketing pitches to try to get you to buy that much more extra stuff when you walk into a store. How do you resist that temptation and stick to what you actually have rather than getting sucked into the credit card debt cycle?
Yeah, it's really a hard thing. And the only way you can do it is you've got to have some really strong conviction about that before you walk into any store. I mean, you really have to be in a place where you thoroughly understand your means, what you have, what you can spend, and you're sold out convicted for it.
Yep.
And understand that nothing is free. Everything's got a catch. And a lot of times the catch is that they know that the temptation will be too great and you will end up spending more money.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have got to, you said something very interesting, Janet. You said, you know, help us understand how we can, you know, stick to our budget or keep our budget. One of the problems is we don't have a budget.
Right.
You know,
right. That will interrupt all the fun, won't it?
that kind of messes everything up. And I do believe a lot of us don't have budgets because we kind of don't want to know.
Yeah.
You know, we just want to get by. So another good thing headed into the new year, man, get a budget. I always tell people, Crown Financial, crown.org, great place to get some budgeting, great budgeting tools. You've got to budget. You got to know, and you've got to know where you are with your budget. So unfortunately, not only do you have to do that nasty work of developing a budget, you got to know where you are at any given month.
Right.
So what you shop for has got to fit into the budget.
Yes.
You know, so you've got to have this awareness about where you are, what your means are, what your budget is. Are you going to be able to stick to it? And you've got to have the convictions to really want to do that. And that's the hard part. Like you said, when you walk into a store, so many this, that, and the other thing tugging on your purse strings.
Right.
It's very, very hard.
Well, this is where cash can come in handy, right? If you have so much cash, you can't go beyond what you have in your pocket.
Yeah, it is a great tool for maintaining your budget when you think, okay, I can only spend this much. Don't take anything but that much. And, you know, that's a great tool because you'll be looking at everything you buy based on that. So that's a great point. Cash is always a wonderful thing. Or your debit card, you know what you have in your checking account.
Right.
You know what that is. And you can't exceed X amount of dollars because you don't want your electric bill to, you know, not get paid.
Go away. Yeah, so exactly. You don't want to be in that position. We're going to take a short break. Dan Celia coming back with us talking about how to honor God in year-end giving and into the new year. We're going to get into that when we come back. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. socialism is being purposely dressed up in Christian choir robes by once trusted and very influential church leaders. Their gatherings are growing in numbers as they shelve the true gospel and replace it with a false one known as the social gospel. What is this agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world? And whatever happened to powerful biblical Christianity? Noted producers Judd Saul, Trevor Loudon, Curtis Bowers, and Pastor Kerry Gordon of Cornerstone Church have joined forces to create Enemies Within the Church, a hard-hitting international documentary that will reveal the plans and the players behind this movement and shine a bright light of restoration and hope upon Christ's church. To stay updated about this film and learn how you can support this important effort, go to enemieswithinthechurch.com and subscribe to the Enemies Within the Church newsletter. While you're there, be sure to enjoy a sneak peek of the movie. Go now to enemieswithinthechurch.com, sponsored by Cornerstone World Outreach International. That's enemieswithinthechurch.com. Christmas is coming, and what better gift to give someone you love than a great Christian book? But where can you find one? Look no further than the Northampton Press. They reprint some of the greatest Christian literature ever published from the English and American Puritans, men like John Bunyan, Jonathan Edwards, and Octavius Winslow. These were Christians whose knowledge of the Bible was deep and whose commentary on God's Word is so convicting that it's virtually unmatched. I can honestly say the Northampton Press prints some of the best Christian books that I've ever read. And right now, if you purchase any Northampton Press book and mention Janet Meffer today, they'll send you a free copy of the book Law and Liberty, A Biblical Look at Legalism. Check out their catalog online at northamptonpress.org. That's Northampton with one H. Give the gift of a truly great biblical book this Christmas. Visit northamptonpress.org. That's N-O-R-T, hamptonpress.org. Visit them now at northamptonpress.org. Welcome back to Janet Meffer. Today we are chatting with Dan Celia, President and CEO of Financial Issues Stewardship Ministries. He is the national radio host of Financial Issues. You can check out his website at financialissues.org. And we are talking a little bit about how to honor the Lord in year-end giving, as well as investing in God-honoring ways in the new year, and also talking a little bit about staying within budget as all of these Christmas presents are being purchased. And that's sometimes a challenge. You know, one of the things going back to the year-end giving, Dan, that I wanted to get to is I know there are a lot of people who always listen and say, I just don't know that much about investing. I don't know that much about taxes for sure. Who in the world sits down and reads the tax code? But for people who are wanting to up their year-end giving, obviously there are some tax advantages there. But I think for some listeners, it might be helpful to talk about what is some of the tax advantages are for you when you do give to charity, when you do give to your church or some other ministries. What would you say are the best benefits for people who are giving just from a tax perspective?
Well, obviously, from a tax perspective is you get to that comes right off the top of your income. So you get charitable deductions on any qualified ministry that you are giving to. That is going to actually save you taxes. It's going to lower the taxes that you pay, or it's going to help you get back a little bit more money than you might normally. So the tax benefits, and I think they're going to be around for some time, the tax benefits are a wonderful part of your giving and something that you should take into consideration, because maybe it'll give you a little bit more encouragement to get out there and give. We don't want you to give for the benefit, the tax benefit, but nonetheless, it's something that you want to keep in the back of your mind, and it can help you and your family at the end of the year.
Right. I it seems like such a basic question, but I know there are some people who actually are out there who don't understand that in addition to giving to the Lord, there are tax benefits. Now, as far as checking out maybe 501c3s that you're giving to, ministries you're giving to, how would you advise checking out where your money goes and if you really are giving to a good, sound, financially sound and also ethical, well-run ministry or well-run group that you want to donate to?
Yeah, so Charity Navigator is a great place to go to. You can go there to find out a lot about a ministry. That's one place. The other thing that I always try to encourage people is people don't pay attention to the little check in their spirit they have about a particular organization. And, you know, so much, you can find out and learn so much about an organization by the conversation you have with them on the phone, or the work that they are doing, the commitment to that work. You know, of course, you want to know, are they good stewards of their money? That's a hard thing to find out for the average person, because, you know, you've got to look at their, there's public information out there that would give you that information. Charity Navigator does that. But I'll give you an example of my ministry, because it's the only, it's one that is a little unusual. So in our ministry, we don't spend any money on fundraising. So Charity Navigator doesn't list this because they don't know how to. They base everything first on the money that you spend. So we don't do a lot of fundraising at the ministry. I'm in the middle of a fundraising campaign now, the second time in 21 years. So we don't, we've been blessed. We don't ask for money on a regular basis, and we're not sending out mailers and, you know, things that cost money to do for a fundraiser. And I do what I can do on the radio and, you know, whatever it is, it is. So, but what you do want to check for is that ministry that is spending, you know, 45% of the dollar you give them on fundraising.
Yeah, true.
You know, something's really wrong with that picture.
Would that show up on someplace like Charity Navigator?
It will.
Okay.
It will. That's the first thing Charity Navigator measures.
Wow.
So you'll see exactly how much it's costing them to fundraise. And it gives you an idea. It just makes you feel good and gives you an understanding of how much of your dollar is going to the cause that you wanted to go to, whether it's that ministry and the work they're doing, a particular something or other that it goes to. Are they being, you know, being good stewards of that by not throwing in these enormous administrative costs onto their fundraising that is allowing them, so to speak, to keep more of your money for things that aren't the purpose of the ministry? So Charity Navigator will be a place that will let you know that. And again, get to know who you're giving to. You know, I always tell people to say, used to say more when I was sitting with more people, they would say, you know, who should I give to? And I've always said, that's between you and the Lord. I don't want to get involved in that. I'll tell you who not to give to if you give me a couple of names. But I can't, you know, I want you to pray about that before you give. And I think it's the reason why so many faithful givers give to the same places all the time.
True.
And, you know, keep it simple, because they get to know the organization and what they're about and what they're doing. And that's where that comfort you know, that comfort comes from. And I would suggest everybody to really try to get to know the organization. Just like walking into the store to shop and all these sales and discount cards and $5 off certificate, and all these things they're giving you to try to get to buy more, you know, you need to not get caught up in the emotional part of a particular organization. I never gave to that organization, but oh man, they're doing this wonderful thing. I mean, they've got to express what they're doing. I get that. But again, get to know if the emotion is, if the organization is worthy of that emotion, and really start to get to know it a little bit if you're going to start giving to it.
Well, that's really good advice. Now, when we're heading into the new year, and I know people are thinking about investing and people are looking at the market and they're thinking about interest rates, as they always do. But when you're investing, you have things to consider, not only the return on your money, but also whether or not you're investing in companies, if you're in the stock market, that don't undermine Christian values. What would be a couple of quick pointers in that regard?
Well, you know, one of the things you don't want to do is you don't want to give to a company that is giving to Planned Parenthood.
Yes.
Because when you buy a stock, Janet, You own part of that company.
Yes.
That's your money they're giving away. And you should have a right or a say about that. And you don't want to invest in companies that are maybe using your investments and you're going to encourage and help a company that is giving to abortion and pornography and gambling. They're just three things destroying our families. And you don't want to give to those things. But more importantly, those things grieve the heart of God. They grieve the heart of God. Mm. And the money that you're giving is God's money.
Yeah.
He's entrusting you to be a good steward of it.
Right.
And there are a lot of companies that I know for certain that God wouldn't be giving to. Here's the hard part. It's hard to know. It's really hard to know.
Yeah, it takes time.
Now, people can go on the website, my website. They can drop me a note. Somebody will get back to them and let them know, yes or no. There are other organizations out there that they can find out. I don't trust the list. Everybody has a different way of measuring that. I measure everything based on biblical truth, and you know, look for certain things that would honor or displease God. And there's ways of doing that. But our organization, we pay $17,000 a year just to subscribe to an organization that gives us all the detail.
Wow.
On all the financials, so that we know where every nickel is going. So you can't just get that as it's public information, but you got to request it. You got to know where to get it and, you know, those kinds of things. So you're forced to trust a couple of organizations. And again, I know good organizations that think they're being biblically responsible with their investors' money that aren't at all. And it is a very difficult thing. I think your heart has to want to do it. And I would just say, you know, if you contact, I hate to sound self-serving here. I'm not. I don't want to do that. But if you contact us at Financial Issues, you know, info@financialissues.org, you tell us, hey, is this company this
yeah.
company or this company?
Yep.
And we can tell you in about 5 seconds.
Sounds great.
Shoot off an email to you.
I love it. Financialissues.org is the website. We are out of time, but so good to talk with Dan Celia. Dan, great to talk to you. Appreciate your being with us. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Janet. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, and God bless you. Thanks again for being here. We'll see you next time on Janet Mefford Today.